You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Postcard Time. Noel Debien. Noel, this is a bit of personal odyssey for you. We've had three or four trips around Africa and now we're having another.
Well, it was an occasional thing in that Marlene McIntyre, who is the communications director for Oxfam, who's been setting up a lot of these Oxfam people for us over the years, is leaving Oxfam. And I said to her, find me one of your most interesting people as a celebration of goodbye, Marlene, and we'll say it. And she said to me, you've got to go to Kenya, because my friend Beatrice Karanja is there and she's a great talker, she told me, and there's a lot going on in Africa. And I thought, I couldn't say no, having been there earlier.
Of course, you've just come back from Kenya.
I know, I don't want to bore people by talking about it all the time, but...
But you will.
I will. She said, go to Kenya. So I said, I'll go to Kenya. And it turns out that Beatrice has a relationship with, of course, Oxfam Australia, but Beatrice herself is situated in sort of Horn of Africa stuff. Nairobi's sort of the hub. They've got Sudan next to them, they've got Ethiopia next to them, Tanzania, Rwanda, Somalia. Uganda, the Somali, the whole thing. Everybody ends up in refugee camps. Plus, Kenya itself has had a lot of trouble with drought. And Beatrice is on the line now. Beatrice, it's great to have you on the program. Can I begin by asking, your work in Nairobi, it's a hub. It is sort of the centre of that Horn of Africa area. What are the main concerns you have to deal with?
The main concerns that we deal with in this region are anything from emergency interventions, say, for instance, during droughts or when there's disease ravishing communities. Those are the kind of things we deal with. We don't look at just the immediate. We also look at the long-term solutions. Okay, in Kenya, we're very involved in the pastoralist program, which looks at the issues and the challenges that pastoral communities are facing, not just in emergency situations, but in the longer-term situations. So it's providing them with food during the droughts or during emergencies, plus looking at how we can sustain and build better livelihoods for them for the future. Then the other key program that is in Kenya is part of our Control Arms campaign. So it's really peace building and conflict resolution. And that is, again, looking at arms proliferation.
I've got to say, I was quite taken aback by the number of police, military and other people who were carrying around AK-47s.
Right.
And it's very obvious coming from Australia.
You see that if you go up to the pastoralist communities where you've got home guards who are all armed.
Yeah, the Askaris, yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So it's also, you know, encouraging them because of the cattle rustling, you know, like
yep.
when there's droughts, there's fewer resources, and so you've got, you know, incidences of cattle rustling go up, and especially if one community has lost cattle from the drought, they're going to go.
Then the incidence of shooting go
else.
Up, yeah, and exactly. Then retaliations go up, and yeah, you see it in all the newspapers.
And then it gets into that vicious cycle, exactly as you say. So it's encouraging them to lay down their arms and do other things. And we're working with a fantastic organization called the Tekla Larupe Foundation. You might have heard of Tekla Larupe. She's a Olympic marathon Kenyan
runner. That's right,
runner.
Yep. Yeah.
And Tekla, being from that region, from the arid lands region, she's a Pokot. So what she's doing is encouraging the warriors or the cattle rustlers to come out of the forest to drop their guns, and she's got a athletic training school, so they're all now training to be athletes, and so it's a fantastic solution for them, an innovative solution as well.
And I noticed, though, you identified her by tribe as well, which was something I noticed while I was there, whether you were Kikuyu or you were Luau or what you were,
yeah,
you seemed to be quite important within Kenya.
Yeah, it is in some aspects, but, you know, at the same time, we're also trying to kind of dispel that thinking and just saying, look, we're all Kenyans, because tribalism in some aspects can cause conflict. And, for instance, that is very key in our humanitarian work with our pastoralist communities who have been suffering reoccurring droughts for the last 6 years or so.
Well, that was all the conversation when I was there in January earlier this year, that the short rains had been prolonged and everybody was saying this is a real problem because it's still raining in January and this means the long rains might not even come. Now, what's happened since that first part of the year?
Well, actually, it's now started raining again So we had, it was pretty dry, but now it started raining again. And I've actually just come from a trip out in the arid lands area, and people have started sowing and tilling the land and planting maize.
And when you say the arid areas, are you talking about the northern parts of Kenya?
Yes. Yeah. What we call the arid and semi-arid lands of Kenya are literally, if you know Kenya, if you take a map of Kenya and you look at where the equator is, because the equator cuts right through the country, anything north of the equator is what we call arid or semi-arid lands. From the last drought, where communities lost thousands upon thousands of livestock, you know, you can come across a family who would have had 150 cows and now they've got three calves, and those calves are quite weak. So what we're doing up there is restocking communities. So we're giving a couple of goats and, you know, maybe 10 goats and two cows so that they can restart their lives again and rebuild their livestock.
So these are quite direct interventions. The impression I got while I was there was that the shamba, or the little small farm that people live on, is a basic economic unit. And on the shamba, you have your cattle, you might have one or two running around, and you grow your maize, and that's sort of what you do. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
It's slightly different, because I'm sure when you were here, you saw the Maasai communities,
sure,
or the Samburu communities, or the Turkana, which are the communities that are in the north. And cattle is their livelihood, you know. It is their, they use it for dowry, you know, when someone's getting married, they give off cows to the groom's family, and they'll probably sell off a cow to make sure that they can get school fees or school uniforms. So that is their cash.
I was actually really struck by just how traditional that Maasai life is.
Exactly. It's such a traditional way of life. I mean, it's, you know, it's a, and it's a lifestyle that has gone on for years and years. It's not really trying to get them to completely change their lifestyle and saying that pastoralism isn't viable. Pastoralism is viable, but it's looking at how it can be done within the current situation. You know, when you look at things like climate change and how that has affected the weather patterns around the world. So looking at the environmental impact of larger herds, looking at the future of the children from these communities. You know, would you rather encourage some, you know, families to have, say, some of the children who are still, you know, looking after the cattle in the traditional way, but also encouraging them to send some of the other children to school to get an education that can then be useful in the future for the communities.
I'm interested to ask, I know just in preparing for the interview that you're half Kenyan, half Ugandan yourself. You're raised in England, so the English accent,
yeah,
might in fact trick a few of our listeners into not realising that you look exactly like an African, because you are one.
And I am 100% African. My mother is from Uganda, my father is from Kenya, and my two siblings and I were born in the UK, and then we came back. We were shipped off to boarding school at the age of 10, and just, you know, kind of did that university. I did my uni in the States, and then the day after graduation, I got on a plane and came back home.
Well, I'm interested to ask you, you know, that it's an extraordinary country, Kenya. It's Nairobi's a hub, it's a developed city with infrastructure, but you can go out, drive for an hour, and you're suddenly on shambas, or there might be Maasai wandering past with, you know, 200 cattle. It's that sort of country. What drew you back there to work and find yourself now in a situation where you've got, well, you've got Ethiopian refugees coming in from one side, Sudanese from another. It's you've come back as an African to work in Kenya. What motivated you?
Yeah, I think it really is up to us to come back and develop our own continent and to just see that, you know, we are on the right track. Because if generation after generation people emigrate and live in the West, then, you know, who's left to drive that process? And I think it's up to the educated younger Kenyans to come back and create space for the voiceless. Because I know, you know, although we do have conflicts and situations, and a lot of people look at Africa like this complete basket case, but it's not. You know, you think a lot of these countries in Africa are only you know, 30 years old. So considering that and considering where we are now, you know, we've got access to health services, access to education. There's countries that have free primary education now. There's so much hope.
Yet can I ask you too, like, I know not far from your office right now, you're in the business district. It wouldn't take us, 40 minutes in a cab to end up in the Kibera or the Mathare slum where you've got,
right.
1.2 million, estimates up to 3 million people in a donut who don't have running water, who live with, I think, up to a 15% HIV/AIDS rate. You've got them right next to you. And I think Oxfam alone is supplying food and water to over 700,000 people in Kenya, Somalia, Tanzania. Do you ever get a sense that it's beyond fixing?
No, it's not beyond fixing. I think what needs to be done is there needs to be more dialogue, obviously, between the communities, between their governments, between, you know, the what we call in complete legal work frameworks, you know, the duty bearers and the claim holders. There needs to be more dialogue on that, and there needs to be better senses of accountability on both sides. You know, democracy is now
still relatively young.
It's still relatively young. It's taking hold in some aspects, but like I said, we're only 30 plus years old. So if you think of where Western nations were 30 years after their independence, I'd say that we're pretty on track. I doubt it will happen in my lifetime, maybe in my niece's lifetime or, you know, her children's lifetime, but it's not going to happen. You know, I'm not going to see it overnight, but I know that if I'm part of a process that to start it or to just keep it on track, then that's good enough to know that you've set the frameworks in place and you've set programs in place, or you've encouraged people to claim their rights and to be stronger and more vocal in doing so, then we'll get far. I really do believe we'll get far.
Beatrice Karanja, Regional Media Communications Officer for Oxfam in the Horn of Africa. Thanks for being on Sunday Nights.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Noel Debian, thank you.